don't see the signs, and then domestic violence occurs afterwards because this is a cycle that perpetuates itself. I'm going to talk a little bit about my story. Praise God, I'm coming up on my 30th anniversary with my wife on May 24th, and that is by her grace and by God's grace, and by some transitions that have had to occur in our life where God has had to open my eyes to the way I've acted and the way I've believed through much of my life. And I'll talk about that in a few minutes. I'm going to use the mic and move around some because I can't stand still like you. I'm not capable of that. What I want to ask you about for a second here is how people make decisions in relationships. So think about when you had a job and there was an offer in LA and an offer in Boston. Where'd you get to go? Who won that decision? When you have to go out to eat dinner, how do you decide who gets to decide where dinner goes? Here's how it worked in my marriage. I would say, where would you like to go for dinner, sweetheart? What do you think I meant by that? Guess where I want to go. Thank you. She knows me. Outstanding. What I really wanted to do was start a conversation about how good barbecue would be. Right? It was the beginning of a manipulative interaction in which I would out-talk my wife, and if I was really good at it, by the time we were done, she thought it was her idea. And I want you to understand that some of the things I'm going to talk about today may sound to you to be extremely manipulative and controlling and mean and sinful and hurtful, and they are. And it's how I lived most of the first 10, 15 years of my life in my marriage, and it's how my wife lived with me. We'll talk about what's happened through that cycle. Here's some of what happens in this process. You have kind of three different choices here. One is the argument takes place where basically the best argument wins. So if you have a better argument for moving to LA, you go to LA. And if she has a better argument for moving to Boston, you go to Boston. In other cases, people trade off. Well, I got my way last time. We had this last time, so now we're going to have this time. Right? And then sometimes you get this, but I really care about it more. Then it's a matter of proving how important the decision is to you. And that kind of goes back to rule one, because the best arguer still tends to win, right? Here's what some of the wives have said. Things like, I can't live this anymore. I've given up trying to change him. I can't ever be good enough anyway. He's not going to listen to me anyway, so why try? I had a call from a wife maybe 6 months ago. And she called up and she said, I've been told that I'm not submissive enough, and I hear you write about this controlling husband stuff. Can you teach me to be more submissive? That's a red flag. Who do you think had told her she wasn't submissive enough? A little bit, but not so much. And not just the church, but who in the church? Sometimes the pastor, you know who told her? Other women in the church. She heard it from her small group. She heard it. If you just were in the Word more, and if you were more submissive, you would understand what you need to do to make him happy. It's not just a male dominance problem. And I want to make sure you hear that. It's a matter of the church endorsing a point of view that makes one person second to you. And that's what we have to do. Oh, no question. No question. And that's matched with the sermons that are preached, and it's matched with what I said when I was the church council chair or whatever else. I'm not saying it's not enforced by that. I'm saying that a whole lot of people, including the female persuasion, go along with that. There are about three different things that I think are really important related to how this plays out. I've been a baseball coach, basketball coach for a lot of years. I certainly watched my father, and he was not, I mean, look, I got to tell you, I'm not a horrible guy, okay? I worked in the prison system as a psychologist for 7 years. I worked with what I would call bad people. They hurt people and kill people and rape and abuse people. One of the inmates I worked with once said if she didn't want to be raped, she shouldn't have been home then. That's the attitude. I'm not that guy. I have never hit my wife. I've never engaged in domestic abuse. I punched a hole in a wall before when I was young and my anger was out of control. I've said everything in the world to make my wife feel like she was less than. And I've built myself up through her, which you talked about. And we'll talk about the fact that this is not a one-way street. This is a relationship problem, not just a violence problem or an abuse problem. Because, as you described in the domestic abuse cycle, people go back, and they go back, and they go back. And people told my wife, get out while you can. What she says is she stayed with me because she saw the potential for things God could do with me I couldn't see in myself. That helps if you marry someone who is willing to see who God can, who can make you through the storm. But there are plenty of women that said that she was an idiot or something. And they called her a number of different names. If you're just stupid, just get up while you can. If you look at this progression, we hear it as males from our fathers. You're supposed to be in control. You're supposed to be able to make decisions. When we play athletics, we hear from coaches all the time. You're supposed to be able to be in charge. The athletes that get the best positions are the ones who are dominant and controlling. We hear it in work all the time, where you're supposed to be aggressive and go-getters, and you're supposed to be successful and all that kind of stuff. And in church, what's the word that's used for the husband that makes them want to make sure they take control and make sure they handle everything and everything gets done? The provider, the leader, the head of the household, there's all sorts of terms. We'll talk about headship and submission in a few minutes, and I have some serious thoughts about how we define those things, because I'm not sure. I have several of my biblical colleagues at Denver Seminary that really worry about the way we currently define this term submission. Because it's not the definition that we understand. It was what came from the original translations, and it certainly didn't mean, thou shalt do what I said. That's nowhere in any of 1 Peter or Ephesians or anywhere is that. Okay? So, this is what I want you to take away from today, if nothing else. I didn't control my life. And most of the men I've worked with in my career didn't control their wives out of a desire to be a controller. That tends to be more the type of individual who is abusive, violent, tends to be perfectly fine with hurt and pain. And there are many of those individuals. And for some of those folks, what they need to be, for the most part, is they need to be arrested for their actions, and they need a consequence for those actions. There are a whole lot of other people that actually hate themselves every minute they're making mistakes they make. I didn't like any part of myself. I was trying to prove to everyone around me how competent and in control I was, because I didn't want to be broken. I was one of the, and still am, to a large degree, Sharon can tell you, she knows me, I'm one of the most insecure people. And today, here's how my thought process went today. First of all, I didn't know if any of you were going to show up. Right. Secondly, if you did, I assume some of you would leave after you heard 5 minutes, so thank you. That's very, very helpful. I appreciate that. Thirdly, I thought that probably maybe what I had to say wouldn't be exactly what you wanted to hear. I go through my mom, God bless her soul. She was a wonderful woman, but the glass was not just half empty, it was draining rapidly. You know what I mean? She could taught me to see the worst scenarios around every corner, and what's worse is I learned to be able to do things to stop some of those things. One of the things I write about in the book is this anxiety depression staircase, where as long as you think you can stop something from happening, you keep doing it, working, trying to do something to stop this bad thing from happening. And then once you realize there's nothing you can do about it, then you just slowly go down the staircase of despair, because, all right, it's going to happen, there's nothing I can do. And I've lived my life on that up and down the staircase. This fear of being out of control. What happens if I'm not in control? And then also, and I'm going to talk a lot about this, the next book I'm writing has everything to do with this, related to selfishness versus selflessness. I believe very strongly, I'm going to talk about two models of marriage today in the world, and I'll talk about this a little later, but basically I think one model of marriage is it's about me. I'm in this to make my meet my needs. And this seriously supports the idea of dangers and control. I'm going to grab your hand. She told us a story earlier of a young man who basically said, I got you into the car, I'll get you out. You're going to say something when I tell you what to say at a restaurant. And that relationship plan is based on, I'm in this for me. You're here for me. You're not here for you. You're here for me. And then there's this whole other relationship model that involves being in it for the other person. Selflessness, sacrifice, servanthood. All the kinds of Christian concepts that we hold so dear. And yet I work in my practice with people from all sorts of faith races, all sorts of folks who have no faith system at all. They look at that and they say, that's stupid. Why would I be in a relationship for someone else's needs? If my needs aren't getting met, I'm out of here. And that's a whole different model in terms of what happens. So, quick bit of research here. Conflict over gender roles contributes to dominant behavior by husbands. They often want to prove they're in charge. because they're not certain they actually are. So they do something like choose the restaurant, or yell, or raise their voice, or stand up over the top of someone, or block the door, or all the other kinds of aggressive behaviors that are not physical. I'm not pushing anybody, I'm not touching anybody, but I'm letting you know if you don't do what I want, you will have consequences. You know what I'm talking about, right? My kids told me I even had a look, right? And this is where it gets really bad. I'll say that for a second, but I had a look that taught my kids when to fear me. So they were behaving out of fear of what I might say or do. I'm still repairing the damage of my 2 cents with my last part. Controlling husbands are more likely to engage in domestic violence. Don't let this leave. Don't leave today without letting this message sink in. If you're sitting with and ministering to a couple who is engaging in the kind of patterns I'm talking about right now, they are at huge risk of violence. This is the chance to intervene. God's put you in a room with a couple who is describing this kind of control of power, and you have a chance to turn the cycle into the way. That's one of the messages I'm going to leave you with today, is that our relationship did not end up in the place where I ended up getting arrested for domestic violence and my wife ended up having some kind of horrible experience of that nature. She had to heal over 15 years of all sorts of abuse and trauma based on my treatment. We'll get to what happened after death for using the same. Controlling husbands engage in dominant, increasingly abusive behavior when they feel out of control. When they're in control, they're less likely to be violent. The reason those of us who have the ability to control and do this is it stops us from acting on the violence. If I can tell someone what to do and they go along with it, then I don't have to act like that. What do you do as parents, right? I'm going to take away your PlayStation. Oh, that didn't work, so now I'm going to take away your athletic game. Well, that didn't work, so now I'm going to, I work with a couple sometimes that they'll talk about spanking. I worked with a couple once that had 7 different pieces of wood for various levels of behavior. Right? How well does that work? You know, at some point, the child's going to run out in the middle of the road. I mean, what's the highest level of punishment we use? That's kind of what this looks like, is this developing cycle. So let me give you a little bit of an idea of how this works. Tama mentioned narcissism, and this is a very important fact that I want to let you know about. Narcissists, when you hear the term narcissist, what terms do you think? What comes to mind?
Self-centered.
Manipulative. Give me a few more words. Arrogant. Good. Let's get a little more directive. Arrogant. Good. What's that? Controlling. Bold. Like I'm going to be in charge. Yeah. You know what most narcissists actually are? Scared little boys. The ones who are actually violent and manipulative, and I enjoy hurting people, those people are called antisocial. And those people are actually much more dangerous and more likely to be the ones who engage in this violence. You really have to be careful if you're working with a couple where one of the other partner happens to be someone who enjoys it. I can promise you I didn't enjoy any of the things I was doing, but I did it anyway. Because it served my purposes. My needs were more important than the other things. That's one of the lessons I want you to try to take away from today is, if you're going to look at a couple, you're going to have to look at what their model of marriage is. Who's more important? Is it me or is it you? If my wife's needs trump mine, I don't get to be controlled. I have to say, how are you today? And I actually want to know. And I need to be prepared to spend the next 45 minutes listening to her tell me how hard it was to teach those wonderful, beautiful little kids that she teaches. I don't get to say, hey, how are you? And mom, if her needs prioritized. So let me tell you for a quick second about what happened in the relationship. I grew up in a family where my dad was fairly controlling, fairly dominant, had certainly a bit of anger problems. They were a great Christian couple, they raised us, gave us everything we needed, but mom was clearly the one who was second in terms of control and power. Dad was the decision maker. And his anger would lead to that at times. So I learned how to be angry fairly well. She taught me how to be anxious, so I grew up with an angry father and an anxious dad. I married a woman, my wife Jan, who grew up with a doctor from Dallas, a medical doctor, who ran everybody. He didn't just run his practice, his family, he ran everything. And she grew up in a family where she simply did what she was told. And that worked very well. So she thought marriage would be the white knight in shining armor coming in who would change all that. But she didn't. She married her dad. It fit well, seemed okay for her from that standpoint. But from her standpoint, what ended up happening was she decided that, here's what she said on her first anniversary. We went up to Dillon, this weather is amazing. We had like 4 feet of snow 2 weeks ago, so this is awesome. But she went up to Dillon, we went back to Dillon where we were, and she said, I feel like a bird in a gilded cage. She said, do you understand what that means? And I said, I think so, but not really. And she tried to explain what that was like. So she told me what was going on, and what did I do? Absolutely nothing. Because I was an insecure little boy who was very much in need of being in control. Why? To make myself feel better. My anxiety goes away when I can control the situation. Does that make sense? I know it may not fit the pattern of how you see these horrible, controlling people who just want to dominate the world. But there's a lot of people in the church, and here's what I know. I know that a lot of these men that I work with actually have a desire to try to be the kind of men God would like to be. And by the way, this isn't just about men. I was asked by the folks who published the book to write about men and write about the husband because that's what I knew. It's the language I knew. And trying to write he, she, to write an entire book is very difficult. But it happens in the power player in the family. So if you're working with couples and you're sitting with them as a pastor, understand that it could be either direction. What you're looking for is what are the power plant dynamics? Who makes the decision? Okay? So we had been married for probably 10 or 12 years. I was working in the federal prison system, which helped nothing in terms of being powerful and dominant and all that kind of stuff. Because I was in a system where I was ordering people around, and on one day I was counseling something, the next day I was outside with an AK-16. And very strange process being in a prison system every day. And that didn't help me feel more secure. It didn't help me feel more worthwhile. And then a situation happened where one of my sons, I saw him making statements like this. He said, one night he said to my wife, why weren't you there to pick me up today? You were supposed to be here. What's wrong with you? You know how important it's supposed to be. You weren't there. So I gave him the dad lecture, right? Don't talk to your mom that way. And how can you use those kind of terms? And how can you be speaking that way? And God slapped me across the middle of the face and said, who do you think they're learning from? You're doing this. You're creating these men to be future abusers. How long are you going to keep this up? And oh, by the way, you're preaching in church and you're talking and you're teaching at Colorado Christian University and you're doing all this kind of stuff. And back then, I was still in the prison system, working in prison system where I had been. I was teaching at private college. Memphis for a while, came out here. He's like, you're doing all these things in all these churches and you're teaching all the same stuff to everybody in your church too. And I had a choice at that point to decide whether I continue to be a hypocrite and just kept doing what I've done my entire life, which is deal with me, or figure out how to live a life that was devoted to serving my wife and my God before myself. That's not an easy thing to do. And I wish I could say, hey, God gave me the revelation and everything was peaches and cream. It wasn't. It took about 6 years before my wife believed. She was so certain Oberon was coming back. To this day, she'll look at me and she says, that's Oberon, knock it off. She holds me extremely accountable now. But that was a big deal for her to tell me, don't do that. For someone who has lived her life feeling the best choices she could make were to go along, well, one of the things I'm going to talk to you about in a second is the fact that this is a two-way street, and part of what happens is there's a concept called learned helplessness that happens. You guys remember back before PETA was protecting animals, they had all these animal experiments where they shot animals. They'd have the cats and the dogs, and they shot them, and they'd jump. And then they come back down, and they shot them again, and they come back up, and eventually, what does a smart cat or dog do? I'm going to lay down. You can shock me, but you can't make me jump, right? And that's what the animals will do. Well, learned helplessness works this way in relationships. If you're with a really powerful partner, what you'll see if you're sitting with this couple is the other partner often decides discretion is the better part of that. This isn't a mountain that's worth defending. I'd rather just let it go because maybe he'll be calm tonight. My wife would tell me over and over again, it's like, I would walk in the door and she would wait for me to find the one thing she had about me. And she knew I'd find it because her dad always found it, and if he found it, I would. But she had no way to get out of sight of it. So, here's some examples of what this looks like real quickly. The intimidator is one thing. There's threats,
physical violence. There's the body posture I talked about. We're not talking about even saying anything. We may just be saying, could you get me some coffee? As opposed to, get me some coffee. Or, please get me some coffee now. Right? You can put sweetheart on the end of anything. It doesn't solve the problem. You know the tone of voice, right? You know what I'm talking about? So you have the threats, you have the physical presence. Another thing we do is the puppet master kind of thing. I gave you the example of choosing the restaurant. Much of this is I'm going to pretend I'm actually not in control, but I am. This is very deceitful. I was really good at this. I could make myself believe I wasn't even doing it. Another example is the sports fan. We had this problem all the time. This idea that you can turn Saturdays, by the way, in our churches today, this is a huge problem. This whole idea of youth sports or anything related to that is just incredibly important. So we have all sorts of issues related to sports being an overwhelming factor. We've got the powder, certainly. I'm not happy, so you're not going to be happy. You guys have seen that for sure, okay? So let me talk a little bit about why we would allow control in a relationship like this. It partly comes from the submission we'll talk about in a few minutes, but a lot of it comes from the fear of what will happen if he gets mad, the learned helplessness I just talked about, and the idea that I'm supposed to submit. With the definition being, I'm supposed to do what I'm told. Let's talk about this for a second. If you have power and control in a relationship, you already have what you hear from psychologists and counselors talk about boundaries all the time, right? You have problems with boundaries all the time. If you're going to be one person in power, one person not. So what you end up happening is you have this misunderstanding, catch-up, and submission that says, this is not about two voices working together as one. This is about the dominant voice telling the other person what to do. Then you have this unhealthy submission, which kind of ends up looking more like blind obedience. Right? I'm not going to talk to you today about trying to give you any theological difference in terms of what you believe the correct interpretation of all these passages are. That would take way too long for us to get into it. I will ask you to talk with the people you're sitting with about what they believe they mean. Spend some time talking about submission and talking about headship. Where do you get that from? Well, Pastor Joe said. Well, Pastor Joe has his interpretation from somewhere, and by the way, he's a man, right? So how does that all work, right? What we end up with is what ends up looking like borderline abusiveness and emotional abuse because it's coming out of a desire to try to fulfill some of these verses that are acted out in the sense of power and control rather than honor and respect, okay? In the church, there are three areas that I want to make sure we identify. The church has a very difficult time teaching men anything about anger at all. For the most part, how many of you have been in a church, in any church, and you've had a class taught on anger management in your church? Yay, three. That's better than I would expect. Outstanding. The church does not talk about anger. The church says you're not supposed to get angry, so just don't do it. Right? Men will come into me and say, my church just says just get over it. Go out and play softball in the afternoons, or lift weights, or do something. Just get over it. We don't talk about what anger actually means. In addition, we have websites like psychologyisthedevil.com and that kind of stuff, right, that are still saying counseling. I shouldn't be talking to you here, by the way. Please understand, there are people who would say, Sharon Hargrave should not have had this session again. This is not what we should be doing today. There are churches that would be upset about what I'm saying today and what Tama was saying. That's not what the church wants to talk about. There's this competing. They don't have to be mutually exclusive. Counseling and psychology can work within a spirituality context if you understand the integration of what you're doing and how you're doing it. I mentioned also that this whole idea, there's some churches that still maintain that mental health disorders aren't even real, right? So please understand that we have situations where, who's the number one person that tends to hear about mental health disorders, by the way, in a person's life? Two people, actually, that tend to hear about it before anybody else. Medical doctors and pastors. They hear about the symptoms. Medical doctors give you medications. Pastors often tell them that they have a spiritual problem and they need prayer. I have couples who come in to me and say, I know your office is at the seminary, Dr. Welsh. I know You kind of have that whole seminary background, but I don't have any of that God stuff. I've heard that before. I've been told too many times that my marriage problems are all based on me just not being spiritual enough. If you'll actually listen to me, I might talk to you. Be careful that the first words out of your mouth aren't just be more spiritual and your problem will go away. For someone who doesn't even trust that their relationship can get better, they don't really want to hear that from someone who's supposed to be helping and supporting. Okay, so we talked a bit about this, but here's the two ways I see this happening. The church is encouraging or discouraging women's voices by what it says. And I'm not going to get into egalitarianism versus complementarianism. I don't even know whether the church is talking enough about that. I don't know whether all of you, with the churches you've been in, could clearly define the difference between egalitarianism and complementarianism. It's hard for any of us, and I teach in seminary. Those are difficult words. Is there an equality-based kind of process based on two partners sharing together? Right? Or is it largely based on power and control where one party is lower than the other? I'm not saying that I'm trying to preach egalitarianism or complementarianism or say that your interpretation of Ephesians has to be a certain way. What I will say is nowhere in any of the passages that I have seen about headship and submission does it say that one party doesn't matter. Nowhere. Nowhere do I hear that God wants one party's voice to be silenced. Nowhere do I hear that it's okay for someone to feel I don't matter. So please look at how people are understanding headship and submission. Despite how you choose to talk with them about it, understand what they see, what they understand is happening. Do we offer groups in our churches where couples can discuss this stuff? I know you have premarital counseling. Do you have premarital groups that meet after premarital counseling and talk about what it's like the first year of marriage? When I do premarital counseling, all the couples I see are required to keep seeing me once a month for the first year of marriage. Because premarital is great, there's also wonderful things you say, and then you get married, and then the real stuff begins, right? The stuff, and you know, sometimes it's great, because working with premarital couples is wonderful, because, you know, they're the best relationship ever, and they're God's gift to marriage, and they're going to be, you know, better than sliced bread. It's wonderful. But it's nice because when you see them for the year afterwards, you learn about some of the things that start to develop in their families of origin and that kind of stuff, too. Do we help husbands understand the difference between headship and control and power? Do we help wives understand the difference between submission and giving up their voice? These are some of the things I'd like you to consider doing in your churches. Have those kind of discussions. Hey, church, what do we think submission means? Here's what I understand the Bible to say. Here's what I was taught in seminary. Here's what it's been like in my marriage. But let's talk to these other 75 couples to find out what they understand about it. Does that make sense? Let's start having those conversations. So, if I'm watching correctly, I've got about 10 or 12 minutes here. I want to give you some solutions and some things that I think would be helpful to you. There are four areas that I talk about that I think are the most effective in transformation of relationships where there's a power and control problem. This should apply, in my opinion. Tammy may disagree. I don't know if she will or not. I believe this will apply for issues where there's domestic violence as well. One of the things you need to know is in many states, domestic violence, once it occurs, precludes counseling for the couple. Because in many situations, the state says, once an incident has happened, that victim goes to a victim's rights and victim's assistance program. The potential offender goes to a domestic violence program, which may be 36 weeks of treatment. And they're not seen together because of the risks and dangers that could entail. And that has a lot of value and it makes sense. But many of us in the field also ask, why would you take away the counseling with the two during that process, which is the one thing that has been maybe preventing further problems? If it's a relationship-based issue, well, part of the issue is it a relationship issue or is it just this one person that is a problem? And I come from the camp that says that much of marital discord and conflict is a two-way process. And that may offend some of you who really see this as a victim-perpetrator-victim process. There's always that piece of it. I am absolutely 100% responsible for what I did with my wife. I live with it every single day. I woke up this morning knowing that she has to go through today stealing the wounds from a man who should have been the one who helped her heal the wounds from her father. Right? I live with that every day. I get what I did, and I'm doing my best every day, no matter how many times I keep failing at it, to try to remember. I sent her a message right before this began. I said, I'm having one of those talks again, and I'm thinking about you the whole time. Because I want her to know she's here with me. Okay? Here's some things I want you to know. Both partners have to agree to change, and the model of marriage has to change. You cannot continue with a power-based, headship, control, power, I'm in charge, your voice doesn't matter, I matter, you don't, kind of model. And expect things to change. You know what they say about the definition of insanity, right? Do the same thing over and over again, expect something different. So if you want to change this process, you have to talk with them about changing the relationship. My practice is called transformational marriage. The reason I say that is because people cannot be the same people at the end of the marriage process that they were at the beginning. They have to change internally. Their heart has to be different. I have to wake up in the morning and decide again today, just like every other alcoholic who happens to be in this room, or every other sinner that needs to say today, I can't do this today. I may not be able to do it, and trust me, about 3 nights ago, I screwed up. My wife let me know. I made a huge mistake. I got tired. I was frustrated. And we're talking about the fact that I'm a little bit overwhelmed by the stuff I'm doing right now. And I fell back into the old patterns. 30 years. In the last 15, I've been trying every day. And she's like, that's not okay. It's hard to change. One of the things you could do is look at creating hope. This is the first point I want to give you. One of four I'll give you. Number one, I want you to realize most of these folks do not believe it can change. Please hear me on that. If they're sitting in your pastor's office, or in your office as a pastor, and you're talking to them, and you're saying, well, if you just do this communication skill, right, or, you know, read this book on love, or, you know, take the Love Dare challenge. I mean, I love the Love Dare tasks. That's wonderful stuff. But that ain't going to solve this pattern. It's just not. There's too much control and power and violence and anger and manipulation involved in that. There's got to be more to it. So consider giving your couple's hope by realizing that it's usually the non-controlling partner who's lost hope. They don't see that it'll be any different. And here's what they've done. You know that commercial on TV now about the settlers? Right? You know, the cable commercial, whatever. We settle. We don't have, you know, it's been whatever it is. And then they're living in the old days because they've settled. This is what wives tell me all the time. It's better than it could be. Don't ask me to try and stir things up, because I've lived this for 12 years and I know how to manage him, and it's better than it would be. And they settle for much less than God could offer the kind of marriage that he wanted. The challenge is, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. I already know how he's going to respond. I know he won't change. Why would I try? And as a counselor or a pastor or a support person who's with them, you're trying to figure out, what am I going to do? Because the bar has been set so low for so long. There's been so much failure. I coach baseball teams, and baseball is a failure-based sport. It's like the best ticket to go up there and fail 7 out of 10 times. The kids can't get that. They're like, what did I struck out, coach? I'm like, yeah, you're supposed to. Congratulations. It's a failure-based thing. And with all this failure that's occurred in these relationships, it's hard to change. Point number two, I really want you to consider the idea that the selfishness versus selflessness concept is something you need to think about. We've done surveys with college students. They tell us they expect to be married 2.8 times. College rate. There is a concept out there called the starter wife. The starter marriage. USA Network had a show 2 years ago called the starter wife. I have couples coming in talking to me in premarital saying, well, I know this won't be the person I'm with forever, but I want to make sure I at least get it right so it isn't. They're starting out expecting. And I'm not talking about just secular couples. I'm talking about couples in the church who have been brought up in the church. But they've seen so much divorce, so much separation, so much violence, so much anger, they expect it before. If you want to consider this, one thing I would do is take a look at this quote from C.S. Lewis. This is, I think, one little part of what Christ meant by saying that a good thing will not really live unless it first dies. It is simply no good trying to keep any thrill. That's the very worst thing you can do. Let the thrill go, let it die away, and we'll find you living in a new world of new thrills all the time. There is something about dying to yourself and considering selfless marriage as opposed to selfish marriage that I really want you to consider being worthy. I know it sounds like common sense, like, just be selfless and look at the other person. And all the love books talk about it. Ask yourself right now in your relationship, in the last week, what were your decisions based on? Today, whatever you did since you woke up this morning, was it based on honoring and respecting and building up and empowering your partner in ways they could never imagine? Or did you wake up and take care of things you need? When a decision has to be made where you can't have your way, do you say, I am going to commit everything in my power to make sure you win this argument? Here's what happened to my wife just about a year ago. We tried to figure out, we had one of those different conversations, and I was trying really hard to be that guy. You know? So I was like, no, where do you want to go, honey? Where would you like to go? No, where would you like to go, honey? We pull over to the side of the road, because we can't get anywhere, because we're not in front of it. I can't keep driving in circles here, honey. You get outside. And she's like, you really mean it? 15 years I've been trying to do this, trying to convince her. I'm really serious. I love you, and I want to show you that. She's still a question. Because so much of her heart had been hurt, destroyed, broken. And she thought she was so worthless. One of the things I found out that has been the most terrifying part of my life is that she began to believe Christ didn't love her because I loved her. She grew up in a less than Christian family, saw what my faith was, thought this was wonderful, and then she married me and said, that's what Christ is? And we have struggled for years trying to help her through the fact that my sins don't take away God's ability to do it. And you'll see this with a lot of couples you work with. Because I tell you what, if someone that you thought you cared about and loved you and was like right there in the corner could treat you the way I treat my wife, why would you believe God would do it? Hypocrites like me can really create a problem for God. He has to overcome us with it. Okay, real quickly. I get a lot of couples that say, I didn't sign up for this. I would argue, yeah, you did. That's what the marriage vows are about. Better or worse, remember that whole part about the worst? My wife gets that. And she talks to people, because she does a lot of speaking in places. She'll talk to folks as well. She'll work with the couples we work with, and she'll say, I'm not saying putting up with it was right. Because she knows she didn't set a boundary nearly early enough. But she also doesn't agree that just throwing the baby out the bathroom is the right answer. Okay? A couple of points here. Here I talk about these two couples, points of marriage. What my wife wanted you to know is it's sometimes easier for women to give in than to make their voices heard. But she wants you to understand that you have to realize you can't just say, well, just speak up. It's not that easy. It's hard to do. Secondly, in today's society, women are often still trained from a young age to make their own needs a little priority. Would you agree with that or not? Does the church do that? Does the church? Yeah. In our churches, we need to make sure all voices are heard. Please think about how decisions are made in your church. Think about how people's voices are heard. Think about how women and men are treated differently. If you're a teacher, think about how you treat boys and girls differently in classrooms. If you're a coach, think about how, if you're working with a youth ministry, do you treat the males and the females in that youth ministry the same? Think about how the messages you're teaching. She also says she believes 100% that couples can make better decisions when both voices are heard. She just hasn't yet quite believed her voice is as important or as valuable or as worthful as mine. She's still working on that one. She wishes she'd tell you that's still her biggest struggle to say she really matters and that God loves her and not feel. Change point number three, forgiveness is where you get into difficulty. I will refer you to a couple of resources. I'd love for you to read anything by a friend of mine, good friend of mine, Everett Worthington. Ev Worthington. He had to go through the process of forgiving the man who brutally and horribly murdered his mother. That takes some work, and he's written a lot on forgiveness. Another person I'd encourage you to read is Scott Stanley, who talks about commitment and sliding into relationships versus deciding. So if you want to know more about some of how this is going now, all the couples that are living together, because you realize we have massive numbers of couples living together, right? I just did a conference, some training with the church up in Fort Collins, because they don't know how to handle all these couples in their church. None of them are married. None of them want to be married. And they're all showing up, and they're like, okay, we're here in church. We might have a year, but we don't know what to do with you because you're not married. They're just confused by it. The forgiveness piece here, I believe, my wife believes as well, is not, I forgive you, but I won't forget and give you the scorecard. The traditional understanding of forgiveness is, I'm going to treat you as if that has been washed clean. I'm not going to interact with you tomorrow based on what you did today. And as human beings, that's really hard. I don't need any other way to do that without God's help.
I don't know how you can offer grace. Okay, the two original words in the English language now, my bad. It's done, we're good. No, it wasn't. You were mean and you hurt me. Or couples I work with, no, you've had three affairs. It's not okay. That's not just my bad. Or even worse, I had an affair, and then I lied about the affair, and then I lied about the affair along with the counselor, too. How much for you? So I had a husband the other day, his wife had three or four affairs. He said, how many is enough? And then he said, 70 times 7, I don't want to hear that, doc, so shut up. But those questions matter to couples. How much is enough? How? If my wife had actually enforced the scorecard, I wouldn't be here today. I don't know what kind of broken place I'd be in. But I can tell you, without her forgiveness and grace, I wouldn't be here. That's for sure. Without God being able to help her offer that in ways that mean superhuman power. Lastly, I will just quickly ask two more things, we'll get you out of here. I want to remind you that every time you say something negative, it takes about 5 to 7 positive things to outdo that. So all of couples will come in and will shout, you did this, you did that, you did that. I'm like, well, get going. You got 21 positive things to say. What you got? You have to realize that you have to replace all that negativity with praise in a couple that's been in an abusive cycle. If they're not pointing out all the things that they love about each other, they're not moving forward. So there's a lot of research that talks about this criticism and contempt and defensiveness and stonewalling. And all of that stuff really develops really quickly. So my wife would say, when you need to confront your spouse, start with something positive and then say what you need to say. She is a master at this. And I know it's coming, right? Because she'll say, thank you so much for picking up the trash, or thanks for going and doing that, or thanks for cleaning this up. But could you? And my response is to say, sure. Because she just told me. Sometimes she'll say, if you're in a really bad mood, I got to come up with 2 or 3 things to tell you before I suggest the alternative. Right? Before you criticize, think about how the words will make your spouse feel. You have to remind yourself to do these things until it becomes a habit. Okay? I want to leave you with 2 things here. This is a picture of Niagara Falls. Hey, have you been to Niagara Falls? Here's what my best technique is that I think I can offer to you to leave you with. When you are working with a couple, most of the conflicts that occur, most of the abuse cycles, most of the abuse pattern, most of the violence occurs right here at the top of the falls. What you don't know is up here about 2 or 3 miles upriver, it's very calm. We want you to work with couples back up here way before they get to the falls. By the time they get here, when my fist is in the air, I used to work with all these anger management problems with the inmates. When your fist is in the air and you're punching on the record, you can't stop. You have to stop 2 days before when he bumped you in the rec line at lunch when you started getting angry. Think about how far upriver you can ask them to come up with warning signs. What things do you think would predict conflict? What are the abuse warning signs? So you can work with them at that point rather than the other. Does that make sense? Okay. And these are the 2 closing thoughts. We never marry the person we're marrying. We're always growing and changing. And if love is allowing your spouse to surprise and stab you, that's a lot more valuable than being disappointed and angry and frustrated because they weren't what you thought you signed up for. Secondly, wives and husbands can help each other transform. I think Proverbs knew what it was meaning when it talked about being that type of force where marriage is used to transform one another. And I hope it was a meaningful process. Thanks for your time.